Believe in yourself, cause it starts with you, and then everyone else will believe you too. And if it looks like you're the only believer around, just keep on believing, don't put yourself down, just believe.
Our guest this week grew up in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, and earned a BS degree, a master's degree, and a PhD from Temple University. For 40-plus years, she's been a leader in academia, serving as assistant dean at Temple, provost at Spelman College, and the president of Marygrove College. The president of the Detroit Public Schools Foundation and a board member of the Blight Removal Task Force, her name, Dr. Glenda Press. And we're honored to have her as a guest. And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. I'm Jack Rasula. This is Anything Is Possible. And we're talking to a shining example of the American dream, Dr. Glenda Price. Doctor, welcome. A real honor to have you.
Well, it's an honor to be here. Thank you.
Can we start by talking about your childhood and your mom and your dad?
Oh, my childhood. As you indicated, I grew up in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, and my mother was a stay-at-home mom. And my father was an electrician. And so I am one of six children, the second in line. And we grew up, therefore, in a modest household, as you can imagine, with just one working parent. But we grew up in an environment where it was very clear that we had to share. It was also made very clear to us that education was important, and not just important, but an expectation of success. We grew up in a household where we were told how to behave and expected to behave that way. And so it was a household of no excuses. And so it was in today's language, some people might say kind of overly strict. But at that point, it was kind of the norm.
Glenda, what's the biggest thing you learned from Mom, and what's the biggest thing you learned from Dad?
Well, I would say from my father, the most important thing was the issue of making certain that you are always prepared, that you do your best. And from my mother, I think it was how to do multiple things at one time, because as a stay-at-home mother dealing with six children, you had to do a lot of juggling, and she always was able to figure out how to make our clothes at the same time that she was cooking dinner, at the same time she was helping with homework and all of those motherly things. I mean, learning to juggle and do multiple things at one time is something that she was really very good at, and I learned that from her.
You go to Temple University.
Mm-hmm.
You get a BS. Then you get a master's, then you get a PhD.
Mm-hmm.
Then for 10 years, you're a professor.
Mm-hmm.
And then for another 8 years, you're an assistant dean.
Mm-hmm.
I think they have a name, a building named after Dr. Glenda Price. Tell us about Temple University.
Temple is the place where I really grew up. I went as a 17-year-old, as a freshman, and 29 years later, I left the institution because, as you noted, I started with my bachelor's degree in medical technology, worked at Temple University Hospital, received my master's degree while I was working as a clinical laboratory scientist, and in that process, learned to love teaching, and it was the director of the Clinical Laboratory Science Program at Temple who said to me, Glenda, we'd love to have you on the faculty, but you know, this is a research university and you must have a doctorate. And so I said, oh, okay, I'll just go get one, which I did. And I was able to receive my degree at the university because we were on the health science campus, and the degree that I was earning in educational psychology was on the main campus of the university, so that it was not considered to be a conflict. So I was able to not only be an employee at the hospital, but a student at the university. Then I joined the faculty and became very engaged in all of the routine sorts of things that faculty members do. And as I say, stayed in a variety of roles at Temple for 29 years.
The second most famous Temple alumnus,
Bill Cosby, being the first, we were contemporaries. We absolutely were contemporaries. I knew him as an undergraduate, and he honed his skill in the student union, Mittenhall at Temple University. On a daily basis, he would be there entertaining everyone who would come by and just sit and listen to him. And he was an amazing man at that time. And our paths actually have crossed a number of times since then. When I was at Spelman College in Atlanta, his youngest daughter moved into the residence hall as a freshman student, and he moved her into the hall. And the particular residence that she was moving in did not have an elevator. And so he, like all of the other fathers, had to carry suitcases and things up the stairs. And he joked through the entire process and made it fun for everyone. And Bill Cosby was very generous to that institution as well as to other things.
Temple University is in Philadelphia. So you spent 29 years in Philadelphia, the city of brotherly love.
Right.
If you can make it in Philadelphia, you can,
you can make it anywhere.
The people are tough on their athletes, et cetera. Tell us about the people of Philadelphia.
Well, I you know, I think that that is a good description. People of Philadelphia are tough. People, they're resilient. They are people who are determined. When they have a project in mind, they get it done. When there is something that they don't like, they speak out, and they're very interested in making certain that they achieve the goals that they set themselves to achieve. So it was a wonderful place to live. I really very much enjoyed Philadelphia.
We're talking to Dr. Glenda Price. When we come back, we'll ask her how it was she left Temple University after 29 years. And I'm Jack Rasul, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. Welcome back to Anything Is Possible. I'm Jack Rasula, and we're with Dr. Glenda Price, the president of the Detroit Public Schools Foundation. Doctor, why'd you leave Temple after 29 years?
At one point, I thought I would never leave, but I was offered an opportunity that I simply could not refuse. I was the assistant dean at Temple University, and I was offered the position of dean of the School of Allied Health Professions at the University of Connecticut. And so it was just one of those things where you don't plan necessarily to go, but when an opportunity arises, you recognize that you need to take advantage of it.
So then you go there, but then you go to Atlanta
after
and you become
six years,
the provost at Spelman College. What does a provost do? We didn't have any provost on the south side of Chicago.
Well, the provost is the chief academic officer in an institution. So I had the pleasure of working with Janetta Cole, who was the president at Spelman while I was in the position of provost, so that the various academic departments at the institution reported to me. And so my primary position there was to ensure that the students receive the highest quality of education possible, no matter their major, no matter what department they were in. So we worked with faculty to ensure that quality.
On the south side of Chicago, the chief academic officer is referred to as the truancy officer. So, I'm Glenda, Atlanta.
Atlanta.
Probably the best example of an integrated city that we have in America. Mm-hmm. How have they done it?
Well, I think that Atlanta, as well as a number of other southern cities, had an advantage in that they were essentially charged with transforming themselves. They were charged with doing so by the rest of the country, who said, you could no longer live the way in which you have. Atlanta was fortunate to be able to have an infusion of a lot of people from a lot of different places around the country, and people simply grew together in this new environment of the South. And so Atlanta has its troubles, just like every city. And, you know, there clearly are individuals there who live below the poverty line. There are clearly individuals there who do things that are in the criminal realm. And there are clearly people there who are doing great things at the same time. I think that what I experienced in Atlanta was a sense of Southern interest in ensuring that everybody, to the degree possible, came together. There wasn't the kind of separation of housing there that we see in, say, this metro area here in Detroit. There wasn't the same kind of divisiveness around labor and management. There was a greater sense on the part of the business community of needing to be engaged in the community. And so how that grew up, I'm not sure, but it was certainly very prevalent when I was there.
1998, you become the president of Mary Grove College, a Catholic college.
Yes.
So you moved to Detroit. How did that happen?
That happened in the way each of my moves happened, and it was because someone nominated me for the position. That's the way I went to Connecticut. That's the way I got my doctorate. That's the way in which I came to Mary Grove. Someone suggested that this would be a good fit. And once again, I looked at the opportunity and said, yes, I think I would like to do that. Mary Grove is an extraordinary institution in many ways, but I think the thing that, for me, was the most extraordinary about it was the IHM sisters who sponsor the institution. They are amazing women. They are a can-do group. They are highly educated. They are women who are unafraid to push the boundaries. And so to accept me as the president of a Catholic college when I am not Catholic was in fact brave on their part. And but they felt that it was indeed the right fit for both the institution and myself. They offered me the position. I accepted. And I think that it worked well.
Many of us have been schooled by nuns.
Yeah.
Few of us have been employed by nuns.
Right.
What's it like working for the nuns?
Well, I worked for the board of trustees, which is indeed an independent body. But it was very clear that the sisters and their charism still drove the institution. And it was wonderful working with and for them because you understood what was important. I mean, they were quite clear about what their values were. They were quite clear about how they wanted their institution to function and to be perceived. And so as a result, you felt yourself challenged to step up to the plate, to be able to ensure that what they felt was important was indeed important within the community and the way in which the institution would be perceived outside of the community.
Tell us about Mary Grove College.
Well, Mary Grove College is an institution committed to this community. It is a small liberal arts institution, but while it is small at the undergraduate level, it has a thriving master's level graduate program. But I would say that for me, the most important things about Mary Grove is the fact that it's a very personal place. It is a place where the faculty and staff care about the students and they care about each other. It is a place where they actually do live the mission statement, and the mission is for competence, compassion, and commitment. And so everyone there is striving for competence, to increase the competence of their own work as well as that of the students. They are committed to each other, committed to the community, committed to doing the right thing, and compassionate for other people. And you feel that on the campus, and that is instilled in the students as they are there.
We're talking to Dr. Glenda Price. When we come back, we'll ask her about the millennials. And I'm Jack Pasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. This is Anything Is Possible. I'm your host, Jack Crisula, and we're with Dr. Glenda Price, who in 1998 was named president of Mary Grove College and since 2006 has served as president emeritus. Mm-hmm. Doctor, the millennials. Tell us about the millennials.
Well, the millennials are an interesting generation in that, from my experience, and I have nieces and nephews who fall into that category, they are individuals who are at one level very self-centered, but at another level very committed to doing good in society. They are people who care about the environment at the same time that they are individuals who are trying to gain as much for themselves as they can. It's a generation that is full of contrasts, but I think that as we see them aging, we are seeing that they are indeed the generation that does care about the environment. They are the generation that does care about income disparities. They are the generation that is constantly asking and the questions and challenging what we as a society should be doing together, and how is it that we begin to think about how we live together on this planet?
I read an article recently about social media. Mm-hmm. And the gist of the article is, or was, it isn't social at all.
It is not texting.
Talk to us about social media.
Well, I must admit, I am personally resisting social media, because I think that what has happened is that too many people feel as though that level of communication is all that they need, and people are not having the same kind of face-to-face conversations that are important. And when you hear parents say, well, the only way I can communicate with my child is to text them, I think there's something wrong. And so I think that getting mass communication out to individuals is fun. But at the same time, I think we're losing something in the way of personal interactions with so much social media. And I find it ironic that there are people who are willing to tell the world through social media where they are and what they're doing and what they're eating and all sorts of things. And then they turn around and they talk about how concerned they are that we are losing privacy in our society. I mean, isn't there a disconnect there?
Glenda, the Indian community, the Jewish community, education is the number one priority. It's a given. It's an expectation. Mm-hmm. How do we make this so in our inner cities?
Well, I would probably win the Nobel Prize if I had the answer to that. I think that one of the things we have to do is...
And you would be richer than Bill Cosby, too.
I think that one of the things that we have to do is return to some of the values that were instilled in me when I was young. My parents were very clear that education was indeed expected. You were going to succeed. You were going to go to school. There were no options. There wasn't anything that we understood we could not do if we tried hard enough. And so why we lost that in our communities, I don't know. I know that there are some people who say that it was the welfare system, that people felt that they no longer had to work so hard. There are other people who say that it was the breakdown of the family and so many single mothers raising children. And then there are other people who say, you know, when people are really poor and they have to think only about basic survival, they don't think about these other things. I guess I find it hard to accept any of those things because when I was growing up, we didn't have the government welfare system, but you did have a welfare system that was your community, that was your church. So people who were in need were provided for. And when I was growing up, there were single mothers. When I was growing up, there were people who were, living below the poverty line, but they still had the value for education. I don't know why we lost that value, but I believe that if we can reinstill it as a value, then we can solve our education problems in this country.
Dr. Price, as I look at university prep, Beyond Basics, Math Corps, Cristo Rey High School, Cornerstone Schools, one common theme is... Mm-hmm. They all use adult mentors.
Mm-hmm.
Why are adult mentors so important and so successful?
Well, of course, adults are the people who have to raise young people. And indeed, in our very complex society, sometimes parents can't do it all. Those mentoring programs, Big Brothers, Big Sisters, and so many of the others, even things like the Girl Scouts, they really do matter. And in all of our schools, I think that those kinds of programs, whether they are the institutions that you just mentioned or traditional public schools, having adults in the environment, having caring adults help all young people to understand what it means to grow up, to see the options and opportunities, to know that there are supports and help when they need it. And so it provides a sense of stability. It provides a sense of possibility.
Let's go back to October 2012. You've been retired. You're living the good life. You've been retired for 6 years, living the good life, going to Bacos every day for lunch, et cetera. And you agree to become the president of the Detroit Public Schools Foundation. Why in God's name did you do that?
Because they asked me. That is the easy answer. I was a member of the foundation board, and when my predecessor left the position, my colleagues on the board asked if I would step in. And I did it because the work is so important. What we do with the DPS Foundation is to raise money and make grants on behalf of students within the Detroit Public Schools. The needs are great. And when I see something that I believe I can participate in and be effective at, I simply step up and say, yes, I will do that. And so we really do need, just as we mentioned a moment ago, that we need mentors, we need resources. And so what I do every day is think about how can we bring additional resources to the benefit of the students. And that's really very important. And so because I had the option to do it, I did it.
Doctor, I believe that the state of Michigan gives each student in Detroit $7,100. Mm-hmm. I think that the feds give some money. Why do we need a Detroit Public Schools Foundation?
Well, schools foundations grew up across the country in the early 2000s because though the number might seem large at $7,100 a year, it has not kept pace with inflation, and so schools have less money today than they did actually back in the 80s. The dollars, when you look at the raw numbers, appear to be more. However, the challenge of all of the technology that has to be added into the schools, the challenge of the sophisticated lab equipment for your science classes, the challenge of getting students on buses to go to field trips, all of those things simply cost more, and the public dollars simply do not last long enough to fill all of those needs. So private funding is essential if we want to deliver a holistic education.
We're talking to Dr. Glenda Price, who recently got a phone call from Sean Donovan, U.S. Secretary of Housing and Urban Development. She gets those kind of calls regularly. We'll ask her about that call when we come back. And I'm Jack Rasul, and this is Anything is Possible on News Talk 760 WJI. Jack Rasula, this is Anything is Possible, and we're talking to a most extraordinary young soul, Dr. Glenda Price. Dr. Sean Donovan, U.S. Secretary of Housing and Urban Development, calls you. What did he want?
He wanted to invite me to serve on the Blight Removal Task Force for the city of Detroit. And I accepted and am one of three co-chairs of that task force. Linda Smith, Dan Gilbert, and I are the three co-chairs looking at the issue of how do we remove all blight in the city of Detroit.
What's the charter of this Blight Removal Task Force?
To develop a plan for the city to, in fact, remove all blight. And we are, at this moment, putting the final touches on our report that will challenge the city with a series of recommendations that are related to ways in which the process can be implemented in an efficient and effective, cost-effective way to ensure that we remove blight and stimulate our neighborhoods to be revitalized.
I read something recently that it's estimated we have 78,000 vacant structures. Assuming we destroy 450 structures per week, mm-hmm. every week, it will take 6 years to get rid of those 78,000 structures.
And indeed, we recognize that it's probably going to be about 5 years because some of those structures will probably not be demolished. There are plans for renovating some structures. There are plans for deconstruction as well as demolition. And yes, it is a daunting task. Yes, it's going to take time. But I believe that next year at this time, you will see very real progress simply because the work that is going to be accomplished will be done in geographic areas where you can see impact. What has happened in the city of Detroit in the past with the demolition of blighted structures has been a scattered approach, one here, one there, to someplace else. Now it's going to be concentrated so that there will be real impact that is visible to people within the communities. And there will be a level of community engagement so that people who live in these communities will participate in the process and they will, in fact, have the opportunity to determine what happens to some of that land after these structures are taken down or after the lots are cleaned up.
As co-chair, are we going to see you in the near future behind one of these bulldozers?
I don't think so.
We talk about that we want some pods in the city. Mm-hmm. And then, that sounds great in theory, but how can we ever get people to move from their present homes to these new neighborhoods?
I think that there are going to be several things that will be happening simultaneously. There are some people who will move simply because they see an opportunity and they will be happy to do that. There are others who will move reluctantly because they have lived in a community all of their lives and they therefore are comfortable where they are, even when they are perhaps the only viable house on a block. And then there are people who will not move at all. But that, I think all of those things are okay. Because what we have to do is community by community determine what is best for that community. It's not going to be a one size fits all. You are going to see that in areas such as Boston Edison, just to take one example, there are a number of beautiful homes in that area that are vacant now, but they will be products for redevelopment and individuals who will see that for the same dollar, they can now move into that community. I think we're going to see a lot of that kind of infill that will take place in certain areas that may cause vacancy someplace else, or it may cause a kind of stair step, if you will, of individuals moving into the lower priced properties, then having the opportunity to upgrade in the city and upgrade again. So I think that we're going to be able to never fill all of the 139 square miles again, but it will be converted to productive space.
We're talking to Dr. Glenda Price. Listen to this resume. A BS degree, a master's degree, a PhD from Temple. Assistant dean at Temple. Provost, Spelman College. President, Mary Grove College. Co-chair, Blight Removal Committee. President, Detroit Public Schools Foundation. On and on and on and on. Glenda, you've got a pioneer spirit. Where do you keep getting the courage to take on these unbelievable jobs?
Well, I don't know that I would use the term courage. I think that what I have developed over my lifetime is a sense that failure is not fatal. So you try something, and when it works, it's a great success. If it doesn't work, you understand that doesn't work, and you simply try again. And so you just move on, and that's what I try to do.
You have a soul and spirit of a 30-year-old.
Mm-hmm.
You're very young at heart. How do I get that?
You simply do it. And, you know, that's what I say to people all the time. Raise your hand and volunteer. See every new thing as an opportunity. And just act. Do it. I think there are people who are afraid and they dither around. And I'm saying, just make decisions. Just move. Step out. And I think that is what I think causes me to feel young and to have the kind of life that I have, which is very engaging, and the possibility of being involved in so many different things. You simply say yes.
We're talking to Dr. Glenda Price, and she is Detroit's version of Judge Judy. No excuses. No excuses.
No excuses.
As our time winds down together tonight, what advice would you give to our young listeners?
I think that for me, the advice has to be get the greatest amount of education that you can. And that is any kind of education. Education comes in the formal sense as well as the informal sense of having great experiences and learning every day. Learn something new, read something every day, listen to someone else who is unlike you, and you will find that your life will be enriched.
Glenda Price, you're one of the brightest, most articulate, and nicest people any of us will ever meet.
Well, thank you.
Keep up the great work.
Thank you.
Please join us next Sunday. Until then, I'm Jack Krasula, and thanks for listening. And make it a great week, because with God, anything is possible. Spoh.